I'm Amy Walter. Welcome to The Odd Years. As a political reporter, I have spent more hours than I want to count on the road, in generic hotels, and stuffed into overcrowded, overheated gymnasiums to listen to presidential candidates give the same speech over and over and over again. So, of course, I was intrigued about the new TV show now streaming on Max called The Girls on the Bus, about four women reporters covering a fictional Democratic primary.
26 cities and 14 states in 5 days.
I am the eyes and ears of my entire generation.
I've been on the trail for 3 decades.
Sadie, my favorite reporter.
The show stars Melissa Benoist as Sadie McCarthy, a scrappy and ambitious journalist. It's inspired by the book Chasing Hillary by Amy Chozick, a former New York Times reporter. Amy's book chronicled her experiences covering Hillary Clinton's 2008 and 2016 presidential campaigns. And I had the chance to talk about all of it with Amy Chozick, who is also the co-creator and co-executive producer. Julie Pleck, creator and executive producer. She's also a director. And Melissa Benoist, who plays one of the lead characters, Sadie. You might also recognize her from the TV show Glee or the CW series Supergirl. So here's where I want to start. As somebody who has been on those buses and done this job, I think you guys nailed the unglamorous part really, really well. Was that intentional? Amy, what do you think?
I mean, I feel like it's really important to show people that even though this is a prestigious job, it's entirely unglamorous, you know, so we did really want to get those details right and just make it, show how hard these women work. They're sleeping in, you know, different mid-range hotel every night. They're living out of a suitcase. Their personal lives are dumpster fires. So it was, I think it was really important both because we just wanted that authenticity and for it to ring true. But also I think it's important at a time when you can dismiss the elitist media, you know, to show that like you're getting thrown turkey sandwiches. Like this is not a particularly glamorous gig, even though you obviously have a front row seat to history and it's very prestigious and important. Our production designer won an Emmy for Only Murders. Like he is a true, Kurt Beach is a true artist. And it just really broke his heart when I said that all Marriotts look the same. Like when we told him how just they did these beautiful press files. They were like works of art. And I was like, oh no, you need like a lot of junk food and like power cords and hand sanitizer, you know, so we just kind of like junked it all up.
So you wanted people to see that. Did you also want it to feel like if you are somebody who is in this world that they can see themselves?
Oh yeah. Like I think that's one of the most flattering things we've heard is people like, oh my God, you know, you nailed it. Or I had like PTSD from those turkey sandwiches, yes. You know, whatever it is. I have this whole photo album that like all of Julie devoured and everybody was like looking at to try to kind of recreate things. But I think it's like, I was playing like beer pong at Obama's Chicago headquarters with like Tommy Vitor. And like, it's a disgusting mess in there. And you're like, oh wow. Like the future of democracy is like beginning in this
literally
place. It looks like it looks like as dirty as a dorm room. But so I think
campaign offices, if they're not disgusting, there's something wrong. I think
they're not working yeah. hard enough.
They're not working hard enough. If that's true. Melissa, talk to us a little bit about becoming Sadie. And I have read and heard interviews with you where you talk about the work that you did to get prepared for this, the books that you read, including, of course, The Best of All Time, which is Richard Ben Kramer. What else did you do to kind of embody this person?
It was so fun. It was so fun, what it takes notwithstanding. That was like the pinnacle for me. I lost myself in that book. Brandon also, who plays Loafers, he read it as well. And the two of us would geek out and be like, oh, are you at the Gary Hart chapter now? Like, where are you at? but I think I got really lucky because I had Amy, and Amy to me was so synonymous with, of course, Sadie is not Amy, but I feel like your voice was so important and pivotal to Sadie. So I felt really fortunate that I could kind of just pick your brain, Amy, and really glean a lot from you. And for me, that also meant becoming a friend of Amy's, and that was really special. So it was a joy.
Wait, you talked to Ashley too.
Ashley Parker of the Washington Post.
Oh yeah, I talked to Ashley Parker, who was, that was also an invaluable resource. She was so helpful and really painting the what it feels like, the anxiety that you might feel about a byline. And Julie and Amy, you guys were able to.
We were first scheming up the show, and it was like during the caucus, and Julie, it was like, we were like, should we go to the caucuses? Let's go to the caucuses.
Yeah. We went to Iowa, where I've never been.
Wait, you went to Iowa this, oh no, 4 years ago.
The first caucus to not have a result by midnight.
Yes.
The you know what show. Yeah. That was really fun. That was really great to be on live television and have to tell people like, no, we don't have an answer yet. Why? Because there was an app that apparently never got tested.
That I did not know how a caucus worked. I've heard the word caucus my entire life, but certainly my entire adult life. I didn't really understand. People would try to explain it to me, and I would say that makes no sense. And so Amy explained it to me, and I said, that still makes no sense, but I get it now. Just sitting in the bleachers of a gymnasium, watching like the voting public just mill around a gymnasium floor and stand in little circles, and like they're at a bake sale. And I just thought it was the most extraordinary example of how little we, the voting public, understand the process. And that's what I loved so much about kind of circling back to Amy's authenticity. You know, I love that when she started writing this first episode, she's writing complete scenes of dialogue with Sadie crawling under tables, searching for an outlet to plug in her power cord. And you can see it all over the show, which is like, you know, Sadie, Melissa Sadie is in like every scene, either like crouched in a corner by an outlet or like digging through a bag for a power cord. And like those little details are just so, so perfectly valuable when, you know, when you talk about wanting to portray something with any kind of integrity and authenticity, because we all know, I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, and I remember how much lawyers hated Ally McBeal. They just thought Ally McBeal was the absolute, like a travesty of representation of their profession. And when we started this, knowing particularly that media can be very cruel to itself when it comes to like the critical space, we were like, we are not going to, excuse my language, we're not going to fuck this up. So let's make sure, like, let's lean into all of the reality of what it's like. And that was the fun part.
Yeah, if my purse wasn't like 10 pounds, it didn't feel right. Like I needed 8 different power cords, my laptop, my notebook, my recorder, like a million snacks, all the things.
I have to say, Melissa, you did capture that sort of, I think anybody who's ever had to do that job, the neuroticism that comes with that. I mean, is that your take, Melissa, from all of this, that, boy, I kind of get why reporters are neurotic? Or was it, I have to act this way, but I didn't really understand why.
No, I feel like I ended up at least intellectually understanding why it is that way. And I think it's because of the circumstances, of course, but I also think that it's passion. That's how it felt to me towards the end. It's really loving it as a career and being addicted to seeing your name in print and being addicted to the story and having a front seat to history. Like that, I feel like I really understood and had a really massive respect for by the end of shooting the show and learning about everything that I was lucky enough to learn about. And I just had a newfound respect for something that I really didn't know about before.
Julie, you talked about being a Gen Xer, and Melissa, your character Sadie seems to be sort of the stereotypical millennial in that she is both incredibly idealistic, but also deeply jaded and cynical.
And wildly self-involved.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about her and that inner challenge that she has, right? Between that idealism and that cynicism.
Because of what Sadie in particular is inspired by, and Julie and Amy, jump in if you guys have any thoughts about this as well. Because the boys on the bus and this sort of bygone era of journalism that she romanticizes, it was so pivotal to her wanting to do this for a living.
Yeah. She's a millennial with a boomer soul.
I think she is also someone that just like cannot lose hope. Like she will always have a silver lining, no matter how jaded she might seem. She always believes that there I think she always believes that there will be a candidate in shining armor that will come in.
Amy, did you feel like you needed to have that? She represented that, which was very real for you too.
Yeah, I think also what Sadie represents is this, is that by the time the women get the jobs, they can't do it the way the men did.
Sadie, you're a great writer, but you lead with your heart, and we need you to lead with your head.
Well, Hunter S. Thompson didn't just write what he saw. He wrote how he felt. He found a deeper truth, which is what made him a legend.
You gotta stop romanticizing the boys in the bus. Hunter S. Thompson was a legend in 1973. Today, he would be in HR crisis.
Either the industry is dying or they have to file constantly for the web. So I think there was something like, of course, it's about Sadie's personal arc, but I also think it's like a broader message about, I was just reading a story about how the TV industry is in decline. It was like, oh, just when we got all these like new voices, writers of color, women in the door, the industry is dying. It's actually something an Obama, a friend of Obama said that by the time women and minorities reach the presidency, it feels like the office is vastly diminished. And so there's something I think inherent in the tension in Sadie, which is like, all my life I've dreamed of becoming one of the boys on the bus. It's like, by the time the girls get there, like those guys filed once a day. They were like drinking beers with the governor the rest of the time. You've all of a sudden got like a beast that constantly needs to be filled with the web. You've got an electorate that doesn't even believe what they're reading, and you've got candidates that don't even speak to you. And so I just think that like sort of epitomizes this like larger struggle in a lot of industries, that by the time women and minorities get there, the industry is sort of decimated. And Sadie starts out wanting to become one of the boys in the bus and then ends the season understanding that she can't be like them. She has to be better. And I think that's sort of the inherent tension that Melissa beautifully captured.
And that brings us to this broader question of, you know, even on Boys on the Bus, Krantz does sort of decry this pack journalism and this craziness that's like, why are we all doing this? All we have become the things that we hate the most, which is we all are doing groupthink. And that's now a 50 plus year old book. How are we still traveling around like this, covering candidates like this, campaigns like this? Like, what are we doing? Isn't there a better way?
But that's, I think, what the show, and I'm eager for you to watch the rest of it, because that's what I think at the end, you know, people have dismissed it. They end up coming together to work on a big story, and people have said, like, it's about girl power. And I'm like, no, it's actually about this bigger question that if we covered politics differently, would we have different politics?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what our characters are all coming together to grapple with in the show. I mean, why are we still doing it like this? I have no idea. And also, like, is it the best way to communicate what voters need to know to make their decisions? Like, it's very much a competitive, like, who, which aide is getting fired, and like, which, you know, there's a sportsmanship to it that I think sometimes doesn't serve the voters.
I want to talk about another one of the characters that you include is Lola, who's this sort of social media influencer. I guess we would call her a TikToker, which obviously, certainly in my era, there was no such thing. We didn't have Twitter in 2012, and then, or just Twitter just started. So talk a little bit about her role there, both in reality, but also what did you want her to convey?
When we started talking about who these characters were going to be, and you know, the Lola that ended up on screen is much more sort of comedy forward presentation of this type of character.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
when we first started talking about it, I was personally coming off of the Parkland moment where we saw a tragedy hit a school, and then almost in real time birth a movement of young survivor activists. And specifically Emma Gonzalez, I think, was somebody who really caught my eye and felt really, really potent as a human being, a young 18-year-old woman who had survived the most horrific thing, who then took to the streets and took to the podiums. And this idea that this young person could end up in a certain world with more followers than the Washington Post on social media, who gets invited to the White House in an alternate universe, is on the cover of Time magazine as the voice of her generation. really wanting to create a character like that. And Lola, of course, went on an entire evolution before she made it to screen, but that was the point. It's the kids will save us from ourselves in a way. God bless them, you know, but having someone who's like, I don't understand why you do this way. I don't understand why you can't make legislation that bans this. I don't understand why you have to play the game politically in this way. And just really like speaking truth to power and kind of being in your face with all the questions that, you know, Amy just alluded to, which is like, this circus is very performative and very ridiculous. And so right. Why? What is the point? And then Amy can talk to like sort of what she became over the course of the journey.
I think when Julie and I first conceived of Lola and having an influencer on the bus, it was like it felt like a stretch, you know, but it was like fun for TV. And now I think like, you know, putting Substack in the show, putting all like, you can actually believe, you can believe a world where somebody is covering the campaign with sponsored content and the Substack, you know.
100%.
I think it's a much more believable. 100%. We screened this in DC and a lot of the reporters there were like, but she wouldn't be on the bus. And I'm like, would she not be on the bus? I don't know. But I think the idea was like, as Julie said, starting with the you know, one of these kids who became an activist and super famous after a horrific shooting, and then what happens when the cameras are gone, like what happens when they've moved on, what do you do? And I think also just Lola gave us the opportunity to have like real debates, especially between she and Grace, that are happening
yes.
in newsrooms all over the place. Yeah.
If you're saying I can't be objective, you're saying I can't do my job as a journalist.
Do you think you're objective? I am the only one on this bus anywhere near objective.
Sometimes the only way to the actual truth is to be subjective. Like, you couldn't cover Nixon without calling him a crook.
Disagree. A zealot cannot be a good cultural anthropologist. We cede our right to have opinions in this job. It's sad but true.
That is such a heap of bullshit. The only reason objectivity even exists is because white guys used to cover other white guys and nobody had any fucking skin in the game. You have to be invested if you're going to tell the story right. We go places now that old school journalists would be afraid to go.
Lola,
the Sentinel.
There's a new generation of journalists who believe that journalism should be more activists, who don't believe in who don't even feign objectivity. At least Sadie's like kind of feigning objectivity, you know, who don't even feign objectivity, who think it's like objectivity is white supremacy and why should I like pretend that to have a balanced story when one person is clearly wrong or trying to take away my rights. So it's like, we wanted to put those debates in our characters' mouths. And Lola was just like the perfect kind of embodiment of a lot of the debates I would hear at the Times, the debates that are happening on all these newsrooms, I think.
Yeah. And the idea that this is a person who nobody wants to take seriously, but
right.
if, you know, layered in, of course, across the whole season, she knows a lot. She has done her work. She has done her homework. She knows who's who, what's what. She has a point of view. She has a voice. And watching the character earn her credibility over the course of the season, as she herself realizes that credibility is in fact what she's seeking, and, you know, and to be a part of the honest part of the journalist profession, even as it, in her own words, is dying, you know?
I saw this, I think it was in the 6th episode where she talks about, you know, cables for old people and print's dead.
Fake news churned out by trolls and content farms blasted on social. That is the real problem. Print is dead. Cable is for old people. And I'm going to find a fucking cell tower if it fucking kills me.
I love that line.
And which is totally, she's not, is she wrong? And that the real challenge, and I'd be curious your all's take on this, especially as we go into another campaign season where we know there's going to be a lot of talk, not just about media bias, but what she brings up is the fact that the thing we should be really worried about are trolls and misinformation and people using these, whether it's TikTok or other social media platforms, to push out information. We're spending way too much time being critical of traditional media or even some of the new media like cable, when what we should really be spending our time on is how do we regulate the stuff that's brand new and we don't know quite how to handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think completely. I mean, for all of our complaints about Fox News, it's like, what about TikTok? And I think that's also what's interesting about Lola is she's got millions of followers. She's got real influence. And so she understands this world. And I think in a way that I think the other girls don't necessarily. And I think, the real problem is misinformation and content trolls.
A quick break.
We'll be back with more of my conversation with Amy, Julie, and Melissa. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report team. It's our way of sharing the questions we love to ask and the conversations we enjoy having behind the scenes. If you'd like to explore more of what we have to offer, consider subscribing at cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Odd Year listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. Melissa, I want to talk a little bit about mentorship, because that's another through line here, especially for your character. You have these two older mentors. One is your editor, Bruce, and one is the, I'm going to call her seasoned reporter, because it seems like she's a Gen Xer like me, and so I don't want to call her older. So I'll call her seasoned. Named Grace. Talk to us about that and about both of those relationships.
Well, I think what's so special about Sadie and Grace is that we have the competitorship, but it's a true deep friendship full of mutual respect for one another and for how much passion they both carry for what they do and their careers. And even when their lives are dumpster fires, they're there for each other and they're real true blue friends. Carla Gugino is a goddess. I think I'm maybe her biggest fan, and was even before we shot the show. And she's just insatiably curious. So we got to really dig at what that relationship should feel like. And I think we landed in I felt like it was a really awesome place that was informed by a lot of love and mutual respect, like I said. And then I felt so honored to bring to life the editor mentorship with Bruce because I think of what it carried for Amy and how there was a lot of David Carr in that. And I know, and we had Griffin Dunn, who has such a legacy and a pedigree in journalism and his family. And he really wanted to bring David Carr to life and bring the respect that David Carr deserves. And I didn't know, truth be told, who David Carr was before working on this show, but I read his memoir and speaking to Amy and the countless reporters and journalists that he mentored, it was someone that I don't know from experience, obviously, but when you have an editor that encourages and supports you in that way, I can relate from my perspective as an actor and having people in my life in that way. And it is everything. Someone that speaks to your inner voice and inner critic in that way, and that makes you believe in yourself. But I think that Bruce and Sadie's relationship is one of the great love stories of our whole season.
I want to add some more color from today. He really moved the crowd.
Well, do it fast, because the news desk is stealing this one to run on the front. Sunday paper. You got your mojo back, Sadie? I'm proud of you.
Oh, Bruce, I'm just so grateful that
All right, love fest over.
Let me finish my bacon, egg, and cheese.
Okay, bye.
Amy, what is it that relationship was to you and what you wanted it to say to the people who are watching the show?
David wasn't my editor, but he was such a close friend and mentor. And I just constantly think about what he would say. And I miss his voice so much right now. There was I think it was Ta-Nehisi Coates who wrote a story about the David Carr generation and just this whole generation of journalists who he mentored. And we all saved his emails. So like I have friends who I didn't know before, but I became close. We all became close after David died. And we will send each other, like when Natalie, my friend who's a Mexico City bureau chief, when she's struggling with something, I'll go into the archives and find David's email and she'll do the same with me. And so his words are still so important to us. And
what kinds of things was he saying that had you keep them? Can you share any of it or?
Is it too personal?
I mean, he would often say, there was one thing that he always said was, doubt yourself if you need to as a writer. It will drive you to new ways of thinking, but don't doubt who you are, basically. Like, he would be like, you're your own damn thing. He always thought it was like, I was just like a Texan from the border. I was like a Jew from the border in Texas. He found like my background funny. And he just thought it was like, don't like, cause there's a way when you start working in, you know, New York or Washington to kind of like try to become the Ivy League or the type of person that you think you should be in that world. And he would just kind of always tell me, you're your own damn thing. And like, that's a good thing. So I think I love that the polar bear made it into the show and even the trailer, because he actually had spirit animals for like lots of the people he mentored at the times, which I didn't know till after he died. And then I realized that Brian Stelter was the baby seal and Julie Bloom, which at the time Brian was like a baby seal. And Julie Bloom, who's now a top editor at the Times, was a unicorn. I was the polar bear. So like, he actually had bestowed spirit animals on a lot of us. We were breaking a story. It was right around the time when he broke that big Tribune story, but we broke a big story about the Philly Inquirer that ended up, the CEO ended up resigning. It was a crazy story that was like related to the mafia. I don't even remember the details, but I remember reporting it and I was asking very tough questions. And then afterwards, David was like, you're like a polar bear. And I was like, I'm a what? He's like, you look sweet and you look sweet and cuddly, but really you're a fucking killer.
And you said, that's the best compliment I've ever gotten. Did he write that down?
It was
funny. That in an email?
No, I wish it would have been. He would just write to me, email, hey, polar bear. Like, he would like start referring to me as that. But that, yeah, you look sweet and cuddly, but you're really fucking killer. And I was like, I'll take that. So, and I think it's perfect for Sadie.
The one thing I wanted you to also talk a little bit about, Amy, is just you had to learn a new job too, which is learning how to write for TV. And could you and Julie, if you want to jump in here too, talk about it. Melissa, you as well, of course, but curious how you did that, how you went from, I'm a reporter. Okay. Now, okay. I can write a book. All right. Did that, the narrative. Now I got to go write for TV. How different was that? What was that learning curve like?
Well, I had Julie Plec, and honestly, it's the only reason that I was able to learn this new medium. I mean, Julie will be modest, but she's an incredible mentor. She's known as that in Hollywood. She's taken so many writers under her wing, and I'm just grateful that when Greg and Julie read the book, they wanted to translate my voice to the screen, but I didn't know how to like write. I know how to write to budget now. Thank you very much, Julie. But you know, I thought like I could write a fun line of dialogue here and there, but Julie just really taught me how to write scene work. And also she brings such emotion to her writing that, you know, I would go for the joke and she would just teach me how to like deepen the scenes and make them emotional. But really I learned everything from Julie. So she might want to take this question.
I had a writer say about my quote unquote mentorship once that I'm the kind of teacher who just like takes you to the deep end of the pool and throws you over the edge. And it's like they're, you know, there to make sure you don't drown, but otherwise I'm going to leave you to your own devices. I would say that, you know, I don't have like a traditional teaching method other than the act of doing. You know, it's television writing is a 10,000 hour job where you, you know, you can understand and learn structure and budget and this and that just through the act of doing and getting the feedback and redoing. And Amy took to that really well. It's really just a testament to her voice. Honestly, when we first started the process, there was not an agreement, I don't think a contractual agreement that she would be writing the show. It was sort of like, you'll be involved, you get an episode, you know, but the minute we started putting words on the page, just even in the pitch to go out and sell it, everything she wrote sang. And I've been in this business for a bit of time and you don't see that very often. You don't see a voice, you know, you can see some fun dialogue. You can see some, you know, it's great storytelling, but like it's not very often that you see a voice, hear and see a voice. And she just had it. So I was like, ooh, yay. So I get to look good because I get to mine all of her voice. And in the process, she gets to learn, you know, about like an A story versus a C story. And we both win. And Greg said, and it's funny because of the hat that Amy's wearing, which, you know, if no one's seen visuals, it's her hat says a film by Nora Ephron. When I said to Greg, I said, this person is a very, very good voice. And he said, I think she's got a lot of Nora Ephron in her. And then when we talked about like our touch points for the show originally, when we first started developing it, it was Cameron Crowe, it was Jim Brooks, and it was Nora Ephron. So like, you don't come across that kind of writer very often. So
Nora was a journalist at the time. So she was my journalistic hero, I say, but thank you guys. Thanks. That's very kind. I'm just very grateful that I got, because there's you know, the typical scenario is you option your book and the pros take it, they're like, we'll take it from here. So I'm just very grateful that they wanted that they wanted me in the process.
Is there anything that you said, you know, this is totally how we do things in political reporting, and Julie, either you or other folks on the team were like, yeah, we're not doing that. That's not going to work on TV.
It's funny because the biggest debate and the most potent debate in the writer's room, which could get frustrating sometimes, but also was really important, which became kind of the central conflict for Sadie of the season outside of the work, the investigative stuff, was the idea of who the hell you're supposed to have sex with when you're spending, you know, all this time on the road, you know, and the double standard of, you know, when a woman, you know, is sort of, you know, taken to task for an intimate relationship in a way that perhaps the men weren't. And, but the mistake that Hollywood has made repeatedly, which is characterizing, dramatizing women using their sexuality to get the scoop. Sleeping with the source, you know, again and again and again and again, to the point where it's a trope. But I would say I understand this and I completely get it. But also, this is a vibrant, passionate woman in the prime of her life. She doesn't have a husband at home. She's not like, you know, having babies. Like, she needs romantic interest. She needs sexual interest. And so where are we going to mine that from? Because it's not like she can develop a great will they or won't they flirtation with the bartender at the Marriott, because they're in a different Marriott every week, you know? And so it became this incredible challenge of how to give Sadie a sexual presence on the show and an intimate presence, like an intimate relationship. And so we just decided to lean into it instead of running from it, you know, which is basically, she had an affair with this, a relationship with this guy when neither of them meant anything. They still have feelings. They are now, she's discovering, he's a source, you know, he's a peer and a professional peer. And so therefore he's off limits. And yet their relationship is no less meaningful. So in those pocket moments where there doesn't seem to be a conflict, she gives into it. And then she gets crucified for it and has to defend her integrity and defend her career and to really launch that conversation about both the double standard and the portrayal and the trope was really fun to, you know, create story out of. But Amy would get mad. Like,
Julie would, she'd be like, she has to have sex with someone. I'd be like, no.
Right. No, because then everybody's going to say, oh, of course they have women. So the women have to sleep in order to get the story. And it's going to be that whole. Right.
But what I love about what we settled on is like, because I agree with Julie, she gets crucified way more than, I mean, it's interesting because you never hear somebody saying like, that press secretary should have never hooked up with a journalist. Doesn't he know that his job is not to, you know, it's always like, but also I think like you live in Washington, like there are it's a single industry town and there's like incestuous romantic entanglements that happen all the time. Right. So I think think
like Sadie is,
it's much less I'm sleeping with a source because I want to get the story and it's the only way a woman can get a story. It's much more like what, who are we supposed to sleep with? Like, we're on the road. This is what we're passionate about. These are the only people I'm meeting. And like anyone who's been around politics or Washington or LA, you know that there are complicated, or on a set, you know, there's like complicated relationship and romantic entanglements in these worlds.
By the way, in Hollywood, we call it the 3-week crush rule, which is you get to set on day one and you're like, ugh, a everyone's horrible. And then 3 weeks in, you're like, well, that person's kind of cute. And because you are in an aquarium with all the fish.
It's usually grits, too.
Yeah, it's always the gut. It's,
it's always like the Dolly always. Grip.
That is a good scoop. So the season is ending on May 9th.
Yes.
What can you tell us about what happens next?
Well, I'll tell you from your mouth, you know, I mean, the intention for the show is season one is the primary and season two is the general that follows, you know, now with the big investigation, multi-journalist investigation, driving the train. And it's a story that we really want to tell. And so it's very important that people watch the show, talk about the show, spread the word and share the love about the show so that we get to do it. Because this business right now is a real, it's a real shit show trying to get, it's hard enough to get a show on the air, but somehow keeping a show on the air in this moment in time is harder than it's ever been.
I think you all have really done fantastic work in bringing to life not just the life of political reporters, but the fact that the media is getting sort of kicked around so much, the fact that you're actually telling real stories about what the media does, good and bad, becomes a really important message.
The profession of journalism had an anonymity, obviously, because that's the point. Yep. And then somewhere around the 2016 election lead up and follow up to that, all of a sudden personalities were developed. And I, a layman, was watching and could say, oh, it's Rachel. Oh, it's Caitlin. Oh, it's Abby, you know, and I suddenly found myself really wanting to know these people as personalities, which again, you know, a purist in the trade might be like, this is very bad that you're saying this. But for me, it was like a new shift. And so when you suddenly can, as a layman, can start pointing to people with points of view that you admire and respect and want to hear from, suddenly it opened up the world of this profession to me to be like, I want to write about these people. I want to tell stories about these people. I want to know what these women go through when, you know, they're trying to find their way through this profession. And, you know, so for me, it was this perfect marriage of timing when Amy's book came along. Because I personally wanted to sort of celebrate these women and give them a voice in a fictional narrative, because I watched them earn it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and Amy, you kind of talk about this during the show as well, this idea of, you know, having a brand, which was not something that the boys on the bus did have a brand. They didn't have to sell it because you were in the newspaper. That was your brand alone. Now you have to be more than just the byline. You have to be all these other things.
I know. I love when Grace says journalists don't have brands.
Exactly. But now they do.
No, I love that. I mean, I also just think we wanted to make it look cool and fun to be a journalist. Like, I think it's a dark time. I think even when I was, you know, moving to New York, dreaming of being a journalist, I had people who would tell me that the industry's dying and what didn't the internet kill that? You know, it was like, that was 20 years ago. And I've spoken to a lot of journalism schools since this came out. It's one of my favorite things to do, because I just think, like, no, maybe you're going to be Lola.
That's right.
And you're going to go do, you know, there are fewer barriers entry, and you're going to break. I mean, Brian Stelter got hired from the Times because he broke news in his dorm room on a blog. So I think in some ways there are fewer barriers to entry. You can still break news and reach an audience. And I just think there needs to be some optimism and hope right now. And, you know, Julie and I always talk about Almost Famous. It was one of our inspirations. Like, it looked cool. He wanted to be a reporter for Rolling Stone and travel with the band. And like, you want to, like, I want people to want to travel with the band, you know, when they watch our show, hopefully.
All right. So for the final question, your characters, Melissa, they don't have the healthiest of lifestyles. There's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of bad food that you're consuming. If you go on a road trip or work trip, what's your go-to bad food / drink of choice?
It's candy for me, always candy. I will.
What kind?
Oh, I'm not, I don't discriminate. It's all, yeah, I have a massive sweet tooth. Actually, oddly enough, Julie, it's Twizzlers for me. I love a Twizzler. I love a Starburst. Same. I love, I also am like a chocolate fiend. So that, and then I love an Icy.
I'm a Jimmy John's. If wherever I am, if I can find a Jimmy John's, I'm fed and I'm happy.
Wow. Hey, Amy, what was your go-to while you were on the bus? And what is it? Is it changed?
I mean, I still have a gag reflex to turkey sandwiches. I would not be a candy. I could pass up candy, but I would grab every carby, every donut hole that's been out for 3 days, every bagel from like some place in the Midwest that has no right selling bagels. Like I would have no, like that would be my thing. I remember, you remember sometimes they would feed us themed things. We went on a swing through Boston and we didn't realize that they had put lobster rolls on and I sat on my lobster roll and
sat on it like physically with,
and then I ate it because I was so hungry. It was the only dinner we were going to get.
And you ate it.
I did after sitting on it. So there's it's bleak.
It's dark. It's really, really, really dark.
What was yours, Amy?
The one thing I cannot stand, I have a gag reflex to Good and Plenty. Cannot. I don't know why, but they were my go-to, and now I can't even look at them. I still am a big Twizzlers are the best road food. That's all there is, Melissa. It's the bottom line. It's the greatest.
Multi-purpose, too. They can be a straw.
Multi-purpose.
Does Smart Sweets make licorice yet? Like Twizzlers, Smart Sweets?
I don't think so. Not yet.
Damn, that should be next.
Oh, that is, but they do make a good gummy. You guys, thank you for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it, and good luck with these final days before the finale.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks.
And don't forget to go check out The Girls on the Bus. It's streaming now on Max. Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. If you want more podcasts from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber, which gives you access to our new podcast, The Editor's Roundtable. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman, Allie Flynn, and Catherine Hamm. Thank you, and I'll talk to you soon.